I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The price of your Thanksgiving meal with all the trimmings are going to cost you more this year. Inflation is driving up the price of many basic goods, including food and fuel. It's jumped more than 6% in the last year, taking a bite out of wage increases and savings from those government checks sent to millions of Americans to deal with the financial ravages of the pandemic. Supply chain problems combined with pent-up demand have created shortages of many products across the economy. Home prices are through the roof with a hot real estate market, same for used and new cars. The U.S. economy is growing. There are plenty of job openings. Many low-wage workers have gotten a raise. The stock market is booming. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported Friday that 4.4 million Americans quit their jobs in September. That's 3% of the workforce. Well, here to make sense of what's happening economically and what it means for your pocketbook are our two guests. Justin Wolfers is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan, host of the podcast Think Like an Economist. He joins us by Skype. And Justin Wolfers, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's always good fun to talk economics.
Yes, it is. And Claudia Somm is with us as well. She's a senior fellow at the Jane Family Institute, former Federal Reserve and White House economist. And Claudia Somm, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Yes, so happy to be here.
Happy to have you both with us. So let me just make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can always pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Justin Wolfers, let me begin with you. If we roll back the clock to 12 months, to November 2020, what were signs that we might be dealing with an inflation rate of 6% 12 months later?
I think actually it would have been hard to see what was coming if you were looking individually at specific markets. But if you step back, the pandemic is the greatest economic disruption of my lifetime. And when you can't just shut down an economy and reopen it and expect everything to come back to life at exactly the same rate, different parts of the economy have come back at different times. And so sometimes demand gets a little bit ahead of supply. That's economist talk for too many people trying to buy the goods that are out there.
Right.
That's what tends to push prices up, and that's what causes inflation.
Well, let me turn to you, Claudia Somm, and just to picking up on what Justin Wolfers was saying there, how do you see inflation today?
Right. Well, one thing I would say where I disagree with Justin is that this time last year, we absolutely knew inflation was going to pick up because during the depths of the crisis, we shut everything down. Oil prices, gas prices went really low in 2020 because we were staying home. And that wasn't going to last, right? That was a sign of unhealthy economy. The Federal Reserve fully expected to make up for the low inflation last year. We got more. So I agree with Justin that no one foresaw how messy this was going to be coming out. Though some of the pickup in prices, it's a sign that we really got this recovery going. And that's important for workers. Paying more for a gallon of milk can be a hardship for families. Not having a paycheck is often disastrous.
Mm.
So there's a lot of trade-offs and it's very messy. And
Here we are.
This is where we're at.
And here we are. Claudia, let me go back to you. Obviously, with the advantage of hindsight, could the government, could the Federal Reserve have done something to maybe mitigate some of the problems of inflation?
Well, the two things that I would point to is, one, we needed a more robust, a more inclusive public health response, both in the United States, making sure everyone had access, making sure people had their fears about taking the vaccine addressed. And we needed the vaccine out globally. Right now, we're seeing some real progress. We learned today about cheaper vaccine distributions throughout the world. The reality is where a lot of our goods start, where the production, the supply chain begins, it's in parts of the world that still don't have access to the vaccine. COVID is the root of all evil in this crisis. It's from the start up until now. And then the last thing I would say is, I think, and this is debated among economists, but I think the American Rescue Plan that was passed early this year was better than we had expected because it gave people a lifeline through the end of the crisis, and we are still in it. So people got some extra money this year. They're spending it now, which is unfortunate on extra prices, but they're getting to buy the stuff they need for their families.
Well, let me go back to you, Justin. I mean, can we still say that this is then a pandemic economy?
Yes. It may seem weird, Marty, that you thought you were going to call two economists and you probably expect us to talk about money supply.
And, yeah, exactly.
You know, energy prices and so on. But there's two things that are really important. One, this is still a pandemic economy. And even if you don't see it every day in your life here, the point that Claudia was making is the pandemic still rages, one, here, and two, in the rest of the world. And the U.S. economy is tightly connected to the rest of the world. And the second thing is our usual economic reflexes or intuitions for understanding the economy are not for a pandemic economy. A pandemic economy is fundamentally different. It's rewired lots of things and it leads to very different conversations than in normal times. In normal times, if inflation starts to get ahead, you worry the economy's overheating and there's a fairly standard prescription. But we still have an economy, a pandemic economy, creaking back to life. And that's very different than a normal inflation surge.
Well, let me pick up on that, Justin, and going back to you. But can we still think in terms of supply and demand? When there's high demand and limited supply, you get higher prices? Does that still hold?
To a large extent, yes. But what's strange here is that, you know, supply was artificially held back. Demand was artificially held back. We are coming from a healthy economy in late 2019. We think we're going to get back to a healthy economy sometime soon. And we see demand getting ahead of supply in some sectors, but in other sectors, we see supply getting ahead of demand. So normally we could sort of think about there being one broad set of economic forces. But here, the ability to shut down and reopen different parts of the economy, it varies by sector. And so what you get is very different patterns playing out in different sectors. Some prices in the economy, the price of going to the doctor, are barely changing. Other prices, the price of used cars, are changing enormously. And that's partly because the economy is changing more day by day and week by week than we're used to in a standard economic recovery.
Claudia, going back to you, and I do want to focus on food prices. I mean, people ate during the pandemic and, you know, continued to do that, even if it was more delivery than pick up at the actual supermarket. But I was looking, at least in September, the price of, I think, things like meat and poultry and fish and eggs up something like 10%. And that really does hit people in the pocketbook. Help us understand what this says about, I guess, inflation and also this pandemic economy.
Right. Well, to put it in some context, what matters is what you walk out of the grocery store with, right? Do you have the food that you need to put on the table? And higher prices absolutely make that harder, particularly for lower and moderate income families. And yet, during this crisis, a family of four received $11,400 in stimulus checks alone. Families, that is it's almost 20% of median family income. It's 25% of Black family median income. And families with kids right now, except the highest income ones, are getting $300 to $250 per month per child. That's going to make up for the dollar more on the gallon of milk. Right. And the other thing. So I absolutely want to see this inflation come down. Food prices, gas prices are not something that the Fed raising interest rates is going to do a whole lot. Like these are global markets. The White House can do some things to put some help with those, get the prices down a little faster. But the most important thing is that people can walk out of the store with what they need to eat.
Do you want to respond?
And it looks like they are.
It looks like they are. I want to pick up on that, Justin, and get your response, which is seeing food prices going up, but more people in the economy have more money that they can spend. How do you see that?
I think that's right. Claudia's told one part of the story there, which is government assistance helped. Another thing that's helping is wage growth has picked up. That's not disconnected to higher inflation. Some of that greater wage growth is, in fact, cost of living adjustments. So for many households, they're receiving in one hand and it's being taken away by inflation on the other. The psychological difficulty, and people really feel it, is they feel the stuff that's being taken away. Mm-hmm. And that's the sense in which inflation can feel like it's destroying your buying power. but realize that there are actually some offsets out there. It partly, again, the government assistance and the like. The other thing is we're actually at an unfortunate juncture, which is that some of the prices that are rising most sharply are the ones that we see. They're incredibly salient. We see gas prices. We see them at the pump. And the problem is you see that price and you resent that price every time you go to fill up. The reality is, though, that gas probably isn't more than, say, one-tenth of your weekly budget. It's going to take up a much bigger share of your weekly resentment because you see those higher prices. And the same is true of food prices. I have one word of warning for your listeners because I've seen a lot of press, quite alarmist press, about inflation. I did a hit on Fox News. You won't be surprised that they led with, oh, my goodness, I think heating oil was up 54% and meat was up, you know, some large amount and so on. They were focusing on only on those goods that were rising the fastest. But if you want to know what's happening to the overall cost of living, you should look at the overall inflation rate, not specific subgroups. The overall inflation rate, 6.2%. That's worrying, but it's not terrifying like some of these headlines look like.
Claudia, let me go back to you. I mean, is there, and you're both economists, you might see things differently, but nonetheless, is there an inflation rate that feels healthy and realistic?
Well, for years now, the Federal Reserve has said that about a 2% per year inflation rate is what we want to see. And last summer, they introduced a new way of thinking about monetary policy, and now they want to average it out. Right, because for too long they were doing things, letting it go a little too low, which I know is shocking that zero isn't the right inflation rate, but you do need a little bit so people can get the raises and we've got a little padding. But they figured out that they were doing things that were holding the economy back from really, again, a little bit more inflation shows that we've got a healthy economy. People are getting raises, and that had not happened for over a decade. Now, the Federal Reserve does not have a crystal ball. Macroeconomists will argue, I will argue with myself about what is that right inflation rate, and particularly how do we trade that off with getting as many people work as they can? Because right now we see with these labor shortages, which are going to resolve, this is very COVID related, but it's showing us what can happen if you really push the economy. And not all of that's good.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a very short break. We are talking about the U.S. economy, focusing on the rate of inflation, but there are many pieces of this economy, all of them interconnected. That's Claudia Sahm. She's senior fellow at the Jane Family Institute. She's also a former Federal Reserve and White House economist. She was White House an advisor from 2015 to 2016. Justin Wolfers is with us as well, and he's a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. He hosts a podcast called Think Like an Economist. And again, you can join us. In fact, we got a lot of comments already, which is terrific. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with two economists, Claudia Sahm and Justin Wolfers. We've been focusing on the rate of inflation. And let me go back to you, Justin Wolfers. Did government spending, and during the pandemic, as we know, the government spent trillions of dollars, largely, at least in the beginning, directly to Americans who were feeling the ravages, frankly, of the pandemic. Did that create some of the inflation that we're seeing today?
Let me sound like a politician and say, okay, can we add some context before I answer that?
Sure. Go ahead. We like context.
Which is, I want to go back to 2008, 2009, which was the global financial crisis. The global economy and the U.S. economy cratered, and we had to figure out a way forward. The Fed back then, as it did during COVID, cut interest rates, and the federal government back then, as it did this time, also pumped a lot of money into the economy through fiscal policy, government spending. At the time, there was we weren't quite sure how bad the recession was going to be. And now with the benefit of hindsight, we're pretty sure that the amount of fiscal policy, how much government assistance there was, just wasn't enough. And that's why the 2008 recession dragged on and on and on and on. And it took years, literally, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years before we got a lot of people back to work. So the lesson of that period is there's a real cost from doing too little. If we learned anything then, we'd hope that this time we'd run the opposite risk of perhaps doing too much. And so there is an argument to be had. Did we do too much or did we do the right amount? But realize there's a trade-off here, which is if we had done somewhat less, we'd have fewer people in jobs today.
Right.
So one view is do as much as you can, have a pause, see if that caused inflation. And if it did, then mop up the mess. And if it didn't, then you got lucky, you got the right amount. But doing too little definitely creates suffering.
I wonder to you, Claudia, and we've been referencing the pandemic, but if everyone got vaccinated, wore a mask, abided by the COVID guidelines from the CDC, would the economy be in better shape?
Yes.
I mean,
the economy is going to be in better shape when we're back to normal. As long as the pandemic is here, that is not normal, right? And so there's an economic cost, the disruption, and the longer it takes to get the pandemic under control, the longer it takes to get the economy running, the global economy running, it's going to take more and it's going to be harder to get back to February of 2020, right? Damage does build up. Right now, if everything with the pandemic, wave of the wand was fixed, it would take months and months to get supply chains figured out, right? So it's not like inflation. If we all got vaccines tomorrow, inflation is not stopping tomorrow, right? Like it's going to take some time to work out of it. And then the other thing that we just have to keep in mind is that people are dying, right? Like you can't, so the prices are real, you know, that they've gone up, but there's a lot of people that would like to still be here and paying those prices. So it's a really tough, this really is a mess. At this point, I'd say anything would help, right? It's not just about vaccines and public health. We have to think about fixing the economy. And then also one last thing I'd say is COVID preyed on the structural problems, the inequalities we had before COVID. We can see them now. Let's go fix them. In terms of longer term legislation, businesses doing things different, state and local governments. So we can do a lot of things in this moment to get us back on track.
Would that be something like the Build Back Better program, which focuses a lot of support for working families, Claudia?
Absolutely. So I like to call it the kids care and climate legislation.
I really think that's a much better name.
What's in it. And one piece of it that I have been a big proponent based on data and research is the new child tax credit that essentially is nearly universal. Only the highest income families don't get it. For the first time, we're getting money, just money, to families that live in deep poverty, to those children who are impoverished. And that's a big change. It's been a huge lifeline right now, like I talked about with the grocery store and the prices. Going forward, that's a way to invest in our future. Like our children are our best investment. So that's the child tax credit was in the rescue plan. Right now, Congress is talking about extending it, and they're trying to figure out how long they extend it and exactly the details. That's one where it's like, just go for it. Like that has a lot of potential upsides for all of us.
To you, Justin, just yesterday, the president signed the infrastructure bill. It's something, you know, more than $500 billion new spending on infrastructure. Is that a smart investment? And would it help mitigate some of the things we've been talking about?
So there's a concern among some conservatives that more government spending at the present moment will create more inflation. I think that's mistaken. That spending is spending that comes out over many years. And the government does nothing quickly. So that money is – that spending is going to hit the economy hopefully when a large part of the pandemic is behind us and a large part of the current supply chain issues are behind us. So I'm not worried about it as being an immediate short-term inflationary burst. There's this deeper question, which is how can we make the economy a little more robust? So when it gets hit by these shocks – we don't have these sorts of issues arise. And that's where, you know, in the infrastructure bill – you know, things like better ports, better broadband, better roads, better bridges actually do help make the economy somewhat more robust to these sorts of shocks. There's not going to be an immediate payoff straight away, but hopefully we just have fewer of these conversations in future decades.
Let me just read a couple of comments, reintroduce the two of you, and we've got another guest who's going to join us. Stu says inflation is a worldwide phenomenon, not just in America, and adds some politicians use it as a weapon. Kyle says we found that shopping at farmers markets saved us a huge amount of money in the past year and a half. We're going to continue this, also start looking for meats, dairies, etc. We are talking about the U.S. economy, focusing on inflation, but as we are learning, there are many pieces of the economy connected to buying and spending and demand and shortages. Justin Wolfers is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. Claudia Somm is a senior fellow at the Jane Family Institute. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Joining us now is Pat Kennedy, founder and executive director of the Greater Philadelphia Diaper Bank. That's a nonprofit that collects and distributes diapers to homeless shelters, to food pantries, family service agencies, and faith-based organizations. And Pat Kennedy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Is there a diaper shortage?
Well, there is an increase in need, and that is what we're grappling with. So as a consequence, with in price increases, there's fewer diapers at the stores. So, yes, I would think that there is an increase in diaper need and a lack of diapers, yes.
And a lack of diapers, which all, as we have been discussing, this sort of supply and demand helps to understand parts of inflation. My understanding costs about $80 a month per child for diapers. Do I have that right?
Yes. And that is for people who have discretionary income, really. But for people who don't have discretionary income, for people who live in poorer communities, they can't buy diapers on diapers.com. They can't take advantages of sales. They're purchasing their diapers at the corner store when they need them and at the prices that they can pay at that time. So really, it's much more expensive to be poor.
Indeed. And Philadelphia, as we know, is the poorest large city in the country. Are food stamps, do food stamps cover diapers?
No.
No.
Food stamps don't cover diapers. WIC doesn't provide diapers. There's no assistance for diapers at the moment.
Now, on a typical month, and maybe there is no typical month when it comes to diapers and the distribution of diapers, how many would your organization give out in a typical month?
About 200,000.
About 200 individual diapers?
Yes, and we never have enough diapers. We have a huge, long waiting list, and we can never fill the complete order of each of our partners. We're always scrambling.
So do you have to, in a sense, ration diapers who you're going to give to?
We don't ration who we're going to give to, but we limit how many we can give to an organization. We really, right now, we cannot give an organization more than 1,000 sixes or 1,000 fives. So in turn, those organizations have to limit what they can give to the people who come through their food bank. So they're giving those people 25 diapers when they come through their food banks, which, of course, is not enough for, a diaper to keep, not for a baby to keep that baby clean and dry and healthy.
So if a family runs out of diapers and they don't have money to buy more diapers, what do they do?
Well, good moms, good dads, good caregivers have to be problem solvers. They use towels. They use, as one mom was telling us, a menstrual pad and a pair of diapers. They use newspapers. They keep their baby in a diaper much longer than is advised. You know, a 4-hour diaper becomes an 8, becomes a 12, becomes a 24-hour diaper. That's what good moms, good dads, good families have to do.
So how do we fix this problem?
Well, there are some bills in Congress. The End Diaper Need Act, which has been submitted multiple years. There's also the Diaper Assistance Act. So allowing states to, you know, provide diapers, to support diaper banks, all of that would be a help.
Well, we appreciate what you do. And Pat Kennedy, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks for this opportunity.
Absolutely. She is founder and executive director of the Greater Philadelphia Diaper Bank, and we are talking about our economy. Obviously, that was focusing on people who literally cannot afford to keep their children in diapers over the course of a day, a week, a month. Talking with Justin Wolfers and Claudia Somm, they are both economists. Justin, any reaction to what we heard from Pat Kennedy?
I mean, the first is God bless Pat and the work that she's doing.
Yeah.
The second is, I think what I heard from her was not really that it's just the cost of inflation. For low-income families, the income's not stretching far enough to buy everything they need. So what is it there for? What are the economic solutions we need here? One, we need work for everyone. A lot of low-income families are low-income because mom or dad can't find work. And then two, we need to make sure that when people find work, they're able to earn a living wage. Again, I want to highlight both of those themes, one, because they're important, and two, because they're not necessarily directly related to inflation. They're pointing to broader economic ills.
Well, and we learned, as you were saying, Claudia Somm, that during the pandemic and as a result of the impact of the pandemic revealing these inequities in our economy, that a number of low-wage workers, they might remain low-wage workers, but they aren't as paid as poorly as they were. We're seeing jobs being offered at, you know, instead of $12 or $10 an hour, closer to $15 an hour. Again, what does that tell us?
Right. Well, first, I'd like to say, listening to Pat, and I've known of diaper banks and have donated to them in the past, it just makes my blood boil. Right. We live in the richest country in the world, and there should be no mother or father that has to put their child in newspapers. I mean, this is not acceptable. Poverty is a policy choice. Right. And so I think, I mean, absolutely everything Pat talked about, we need to make sure that families have access to what they need to raise their children, including diapers. I agree with Justin and what you were noting about we need people to have living wages. And I absolutely believe with relief like programs like the child tax credit, just give them money. It is infuriating that programs like the child tax credit in the past, the earned income tax credit, you had to, quote unquote, work for it. And I just that it's we have in the past hurt and held back the children who need it. They really need the help. So I see there's a lot of promise in terms of where we're pointing in terms of policy. But I worry a lot because that discussion about you got to work for your relief, you got to work for that money that you even get from the government, let alone from your wage jobs. We got to stop that. Right. Like this is not acceptable where we're at.
Is that acceptable to you, Justin Wolfers?
You know, as a moral and ethical issue, I think, you know, who is it who has need there? It's the kid. Right. And, you know, we often overlay that in our politics with questions about the parent's responsibility. But whatever the parent's circumstances, it's the kid who ultimately ends up in newspapers. And when you think through that kid-centric lens, I think you come to very different conclusions.
Let me read an email from Avi. Is there any chance to deal with all the problems we face without a higher tax on top earners? How about a higher tax on gasoline? They may hit two birds in one shot. What do you think of that, Justin?
I love the idea.
Do you? Okay.
And I say that despite the fact that I'm a driver. The U.S. has among the lowest tax on gasoline in the world. That's why so many of us drive SUVs. We drive these big honking cars. The rest of the world doesn't. We're polluting the environment. And if we were to raise taxes on gasoline, that's an incentive for each of us to make more environmentally responsible choices. Politically, that appears to have been a non-starter for far too long, but we've yet to both raise revenue and improve the environment. You may have concerns that this would have a particularly hard impact on working-class families, but you could make sure that you channel some of the funds we raise through a gas tax towards helping those families. So this is a way we can both make the economy more efficient and fund the government.
Do you agree, Claudia?
So I would pivot a little bit in that I really think that we need to separate the debate about government spending, particularly when they're long-term investments, like in our children, from tax policy, right? These are, especially the long-term investments, they don't pay for themselves, but they're going to pay for the cost of just financing that debt. The U.S. government is not like anything else. It is not a household that has to balance its budget and can't always get credit. It's not a state and local government that has to balance its budget or a business. They have the very special ability and the very special responsibility. Like, I'm not saying just let her rip and print the money, but they have the ability to do things, the investments in our future, they got to do it well. And then there's another question about equity in taxes. Who pays? Or this discussion about over the long term, we need to save this planet, like we'd like to have somewhere to live and exist. Looking at some of the taxes that we put on gasoline or other, the typical energy sources, that can make sense. I would not do that right now. You know, there's a difference between a long term letting people adjust and fixing short term problems. But to me, those are two really separate conversations. And it's unfortunate when they get mushed on top of each other, because I think then we make bad choices because we're trying to do it all, like fix both problems at the same time.
Well, we are talking with two economists about our economy. We've been focusing a lot on the fact that inflation is up. It's at a, frankly, 31-year high. And a number of Americans are feeling the pain, although we're hearing from both of our guests that some of that is offset by some government investment to help families make it through the pandemic. Justin Wolfers and Claudia Sahm staying with us for the rest of the hour. You can as well. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with economist Justin Wolfers and Claudia Sahm. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Justin, let me go back to you. What, if anything, can the Federal Reserve do, either short-term or long-term, to deal with the current rate of inflation or even the Biden administration, the White House?
So the Fed has only one tool, and it's a pretty blunt tool, which is it can raise interest rates. And if it raises interest rates, that will lead people to spend less, and that will reduce inflationary pressure. It will also, because people spend less, lead businesses to produce less and so raise unemployment. And so that's the dilemma the Fed faces. And the choice it faces at any point in time is which is the more pressing social ill and where can its tools do the most to help. In terms of the White House, it's a tricky business. So energy prices are up right now. There's not a lot that the White House can do about that. I'm going to, again, surprise you. Remember, this is a pandemic economy. And so the current inflationary surge very much reflects the reality of that pandemic economy. So the first thing we can do is vaccinate the world. Because when economists talk about supply chain pressures, the reality is often what that means is a few workers in an Asian factory come into work with COVID and the factory closes. Therefore, it produces fewer chips. Cars need chips. Therefore, we have fewer cars. And because we have so few cars coming into the country, that's why prices for cars are pushing up. So the start of all that was the pandemic. And the pandemic continues to rage even more fiercely in the rest of the world than it is in the United States. So one of the most important sources of our inflationary pressure is the ongoing pandemic in the rest of the world. The pandemic also matters at home. Because the other thing is, as the pandemic rages, we're not spending as much time with anything involving interpersonal relations. That's what the service sector is about. We're not going to restaurants. We're not going to bars. We're spending all our money on goods instead of services. And that demand for goods means we're buying more stuff than at any time in American history. And that is one of the big sources of inflationary pressure. If we can beat the bug, we all go back to the bar, we're going to buy fewer refrigerators, and a lot of these inflationary pressures are just going to recede.
Let me read a comment from Jeffrey Roger, and actually an anonymous listener. I'll toss this to you, Claudia Sam. I would like to hear some critical conversation about the Federal Reserve. This is not all about the pandemic. Let's talk about other reasons we are dealing with inflation. As someone who was a Federal Reserve economist, what do you think the Federal Reserve could do or should do or shouldn't do, perhaps?
Right. Yeah. So first, I'd like to disagree a bit with Jason. There are things the White House can do to bring down gas prices.
It's Justin, but that's
opening
okay.
Up
no,
this...
okay.
Oh, Justin, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
It's early still.
Okay.
There are things they can do, opening up the Strategic Oil Reserve, cutting tariffs, doing more to get the docks open and move commodities around. I know those aren't popular. These are not long-term fixes to climate change, but there are steps, and they've been talking about it, the White House and Congress. So, but to the Federal Reserve, my absolute favorite topic of things to think about and talk about, the Federal Reserve is facing its toughest year, I think, frankly, ever. The Volcker years, the big inflation of the 70s, 80s, like that was a really tough and trying time at the Fed. I hope we see nothing like that response in terms of what interest rates, how high they went to contain inflation. I don't think we're headed that way. We should be vigilant. That'd be a really tough time. But the Federal Reserve into the next year is really going to have to balance this. Inflation is high. It's probably not going to come down as fast as we wanted to. And the level of prices by this point are up quite a bit. So they're going to have to figure out how much inflation can we tolerate? Is it really coming down, or is it starting to get a life of its own versus getting those last people back to work and across the finish line? We've seen the unemployment rate come down quite a bit, I mean, a lot since the spring of 2020, but there are massive inequities in the labor market. We still have Black and Hispanic workers that are much further behind in recovery, the less educated people in some parts of the country. So it's a really tough, and as Justin said, the Fed has a very blunt tool, and it has to trade off. And they have upped the ante, and some may disagree with them doing this. When they reevaluated their framework last year, they added that their maximum employment goal, they're interpreting that as broad-based and inclusive employment. We have no idea what that means.
I was going to say, what the heck does that
like
mean?
More. Yeah, they have not figured it out. I've really been watching that, and they got it figured out real fast because the national unemployment rate is not going to cut it for that definition. So it's they have a lot of work to do in the next year, and they're not going to have a lot of time. So, yeah, and I will say, because it sounded like they wanted some critical of the Fed always gets blamed. Right. Because it is, you know, whatever they do, it's going to be a tough time in the economy. The Fed, you know, they're a good one to point at when it goes south.
I mean,
so it's going to be a rough ride.
It's going to be a rough ride. As you both are saying, I mean, they have kind of limited tools. It has to do clearly I'm not an economist. I'm talking to two economists, but they have very limited tools, right, Claudia?
They do. And what's interesting, interest rates have been so low for so long. Frankly, like raising interest rates isn't going to do all that much. Uh-huh. I'm afraid we're going to have all this, raise interest rates and inflation's under control. And it'll be a little bit like, cut off benefits to the jobless and this will solve the labor shortage. It helped a little bit, but it didn't solve it. Higher interest rates would help a little bit. They didn't solve it. What the Fed's tool is right now that is the most powerful is its communication. Because we're all looking for when is this going to be over? How do we get to the other side? Jay Powell, the current Fed chair, has been the voice of the Fed. And a big thing he's asked about, where's the economy going?
Yeah.
Right. And so that's they have this kind of arbiter, non-political, non-partisan voice the Fed is not good, and economists in general are not good at talking to people. So this is a really tough, and they've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how not to upset markets, how to try to communicate with people. But that's really tricky, and I think that's what they got now.
Well, Justin, let me go back to you. Something I don't understand. I mean, the unemployment rate is low, and I realize that has to do with people that are looking for work. I mentioned in my introduction that something like 4.4 million Americans quit their jobs in September. We have a labor shortage, and I understand why, you know, someone may not want to work at a restaurant if people are not going to wear masks. I understand that. But how do we get people back to work? And, you know, is it a matter of just having a mask and vaccine policy? Is it a matter of paying them, you know, a better salary, a better wage, so that they can survive on what they're making?
That's the big question right now. And this is why I'd say, as much as we economists, it's hard for me. I'm an economics teacher, and so I'm meant to teach my students about monetary policy and fiscal policy. But actually, I think the three most powerful tools we have for stimulating the economy right now are public health, and public health.
Wow.
And arguably the most important economic policy is the Biden vaccine mandate. If the mandate succeeds and it's currently held up in court and we all get vaccinated, then over time, it's not going to happen immediately, we can start to put COVID behind us. And we know what a non-COVID economy looks like because we had it in late 2019. Lots of people want to work. Nearly everyone can find work. And if we can run a high-pressure labor market, then they'll also get a living wage for that work. That's the pathway forward. I should be really clear that we economists are not really good at connecting the dots. What's going to happen over that ensuing bumpy, is it 3 months, 6 months, year, 2 years, or 3 years between here and there? But if we can get everyone vaccinated, there's no reason to think we can't get back to the 2019 economy.
I mean, Claudia, it's so interesting because it seems like so much of economics is psychology about how people feel. Do they feel confident? Do they trust, you know, the government messengers? Can you speak to that?
Right. So I worked at the Fed for over a decade on consumer spending. And I spent a lot of time with the consumer sentiment surveys. I truly believe that we need to listen to people. And not just how much stuff do you have. You know, I talked about before leaving the grocery store with the food you need, but those fears that people have about inflation, those are real. I can't tell you how to feel. I can remind you got a little extra money, but that doesn't mean you aren't scared about where this goes. And then on top of that, when we ask people how they feel about the economy and where it goes, there are these fears that inflation is like taxes. You say the word and people don't smile, right? So these have their own. And then on top of that, we have a really politicized, like we disagree about everything, it feels like, including COVID. And so you just layer all that up and it's rough and people are exhausted, right? So it's hard when we look at these, hey, what do you think about the economy? It's hard to know What do we need to do to make you feel better, other than making the economy better? Because it's just, it's tough. And I think that's a tool, just like the public health economists. We don't know how to fix that. And frankly, I think we sometimes make it worse, right, in terms of how we talk to people and how we sometimes disregard that, well, you should feel better, you know, things are better.
Well, and Justin, I scribbled the word angry. I mean, it just feels like everyone is angry about something these days. Does anger drive an economy? Maybe into a ditch? I don't know. But
my real fear about anger is that anger drives our discourse and our policy debate off track. You know, realize that there is a lot the government could do or the Fed could do to try to control inflation, but that will have effects on the unemployed. My real fear is we hear a lot of anger, say, from people in financial markets who are furious about inflation. We hear a lot from people trading cryptocurrency who stand to make millions of dollars if they can instill the fear of people that inflation is on the rise. What we don't have is a lot of voices speaking for the unemployed, who are potentially the folks who would lose if the Fed were to overreact engineer a recession in order to bring inflation down. And so I think I want to hear more of those voices, which is a different anger. Maybe it's angst instead. Right. People have been left behind in our economic recovery.
Yeah, I think angst is a good word. Let me read a question from John. A person who tries to put money away for retirement is making less than 1% on that. What are they supposed to do with any savings if they don't want to put it in the stock market and want more security? The difference between bank interest and inflation is ridiculous. Claudia, as someone who, you know, deals with some of these consumer issues, what do you say back to John?
Right. So first, John, I would tell you you're in good company. The biggest complaint they get at the Federal Reserve is from people on fixed income saying, how are we supposed to make this work? Interest rates are low. Over the long term, the best thing for everyone, whether it's through employment income or through returns on the savings that you have, is going to be a stronger, more robust economy. Like when we are firing on all cylinders, the returns, the interest rates, they're up, and they're up for a good reason. Like right now, it would have costs, like what Justin was saying. Now, one thing that I will say, we talked before about children living in deep poverty. We have failed them for a long time. Our senior citizens, our elderly, people who have retired, decades and decades ago, we made a commitment to do our best to not have them live in poverty. Anyone on Social Security benefits will get over a 6% increase in their cost of living. Like their benefits will go up starting in January. Not everyone's prices went up 6%. I know some people it did more, but like if you didn't buy a used car last year, you're not in that same boat. So I think, you know, it may not be enough, and I don't ever want to discount hardship or this frustration with like, come on, bank account, like these savings, what's happening? But we do put some protections in place for people who can't go out and get the job and the raise because they've done their service and they're retired. But really, the big picture is we have got to get the economy going. And then that's what's over the long term will help make investments pay off, make savings pay off.
Yeah, I hear you. And Justin, we're almost out of time here, but do you worry, do economists worry about the federal debt? Is that something that we should all be worried about?
It's such a deep and such a difficult question.
I know, sorry. So, I'm giving you
Marty,
a minute.
I would lose my license as an economist if I said that we shouldn't worry. It is a debt that we're going to have to pay. But the flip side is realize it's not a debt we have to pay tomorrow. It's a debt that we can pay off over several generations. And realize future generations are likely to be, if we can get the economy growing, in a much better position to repay that debt. So I'm not yet worried that debt will stall the economy, but I think we should always be asking ourselves, whenever the government's going to spend our money, does it yield greater benefits than costs? And we should do that line by line on every part of every year's federal budget.
And does it matter? I mean, I'm assuming for all of us, whether it's your personal finances or whatever, Justin, it depends what you're spending the money on, right? So if it's on
bridges and
roads and internet, perhaps that's a better investment than something else.
That's what we economists mean when we say, do the benefits exceed the costs? Look at the investment and see if this is an investment that we really think is worthwhile. And I think a lot of the investments we're talking about do meet that test at the moment.
Well, I learned a lot, and I thank you both for joining us today on Radio Times. Justin Wolfers and Claudia Somm, thank you for joining us on the show today. Appreciate it.
It's a great joy, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Justin Wolfers is a professor of economics and public policy. That's at the University of Michigan, host of the podcast Think Like an Economist. And Claudia Somm is senior fellow at the Jane Family Institute, former Federal Reserve and White House economist. And we also spoke briefly with Pat Kennedy, founder and executive director of the Greater Philadelphia Diaper Bank. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us at WHYY Radio Times on Instagram and Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.